The government will have to make legislative change even in order to enable how it envisages indoor dining to return, and that will require amendments to the Public Health Act. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line now by Richard Grogan. He's a solicitor specialising in employment law and dispute resolution at Richard Grogan and Associates. Richard, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much, Ciara. Delighted to be here.
We're delighted to have you. First off, why is this amendment required?
Well, it's required because of the fact, mainly, that NPHET have kind of stayed silent on matters relating to reopening restaurants. So we now have a situation that the government is having to flap around a bit to try and work out how they're going to do it. They've got six different plans, one of which is nothing until October, but effectively they need to get them open before this. But they haven't got a clear steer, from NPHET, which would allow them then to get the HSA to give a direction, so they're going to have to try and go in and amend the 1947 Health Act.
Will that be easy to get over the line? Do we have any inkling as to what those amendments will entail?
They're going to have to amend more than just the Health Act. They're going to have to amend the defamation laws, because they're going to try and bring in something which says you produce something that's saying that you have that you've been vaccinated. All right? Now, that's fine. The difficulty you have there is somebody's turned away from a restaurant because it doesn't look right, they don't have the right certificate there with them, they don't have the right ID. This is all going to be a real problem, because if they bring it in before they have it on your phone, you're still going to probably need to have photo ID. So if you take somebody who's, say, 35 years of age and they turn up, then it is a question that they might look different than they did in the passport when they were 26.
Yeah.
Now, the other issue that's going to happen is somebody turns up to their grandmother's, 85th birthday party, and they say, I've got my certificate here, and you find that they have got the jab, half an hour beforehand. And you're going to have some poor unfortunate sitting on reception saying, well, actually, that's not sufficient. Now you've got a person being turned away with everybody pointing at them that they've tried to get in without a cert when they might legitimately believe they could come in. And you've got the issue then of whoever's going to be manning the door. Now, somebody said, oh, well, we won't be retaining any records, but you'll be retaining contact records. So that's a GDPR nightmare. So the whole thing is, it's not just the Health Act that they're going to have to change. They're going to have to change defamation laws. They're going to have to try and get around GDPR, which I don't know how they're going to get around that. Mm.
Now, I have to put my hands up and say, look, any excuse to amend the 2009 Defamation Act would be welcomed by the overwhelming majority, if not all, journalists and those involved in publishing in Ireland for a vast variety of very different reasons. But if you're trying to amend two separate pieces of utterly divergent legislation and a European directive on privacy, they're not going to get that done before the 26th of July.
They're not actually changing an EU directive. They're trying to change an EU regulation, which has direct effect in this country. The government can't change the regulation. The GDPR regulation is not in their gift to change that. That's the European Parliament. So the position,
but they will have to find a way to work around it in order to meet what their particular criteria for the restoration of indoor dining, whilst adhering to the provisions of that of the GDPR.
Well, that's what they're going to attempt to do. The reality on it is, if I was a restaurant owner, I'd be turning around and saying, well, I would want them to be putting in an indemnity that if a restaurant owner gets sued for complying with the rules that they put in place, that they're not going to be picking up the tab. Because the GDPR area will trump health and safety and everything else unless the NPHET come along and say, you can't be in here unless you're vaccinated. Then that trumps GDPR. But other than that, there's a real problem there for potential litigation. And nobody wants to see that. I don't want to see it, but it's going to be there. And by the way, we haven't even started to talk about the issue of the staff.
I was just going to say that even if NPHET made the statements of views suggested Richard might be helpful in this particular situation, that does nothing for the people working in restaurants or indoor hospitality settings, and what I would imagine is going to be the questionable behaviour they may encounter when checking people for whether or not they meet the criteria to be permitted to enter.
Well, I mean, if I put this as a crazy situation that we will have going forward, at the present time, a lot of people who are working in these restaurants are relatively young, right? But they're being offered the vaccination now. So let's say they are all vaccinated and they tell the employer that they're all vaccinated. The employer still has to keep everybody 2 meters apart between the staff, because he or she cannot tell the other staff that all the others are vaccinated, because that breaches GDPR. So you then have somebody working in a kitchen and they say, well, I want everybody 2 meters apart from me.
Which could mean that in theory, your kitchen, may dependent upon the size of it, may not be able to operate with just one chef in a space which could normally have held four or five.
That's exactly the position. So the business says, well, we have to do this, we put you in. They either breach GDPR and end up possibly in the circuit court, or they have people just working there and somebody says, I need to know that those people are vaccinated. Well, I can't tell you that. Well, then I need them 2 meters apart back from me. The employer says, well, I can't do that. I have meals to get out. And the person says, well, anytime anybody comes within 2 meters from me, I'm walking back, because I'm telling you now that's a breach of health and safety. The employer in any way acts to the detriment of that employee. Then they've got a case, the WRC, for breach of the Safety, Health and Welfare at Work Act for penalisation, up to 2 years' wages. So that also has to be covered off. And I don't know how the government is going to do it, because I think what they're going to do is come up with some mismatched thing, hope it all works out, and if employers, being restaurateurs, get sued in the WRC, well, collateral damage, or that will take a year for those cases to come through. We'll work it out in due course. That, I think, is where it's going to happen. That's not fair to anybody.
No, and the various representative groups, I would imagine, would be up in arms over this, because just as you've sketched it out there, Richard, it seems like a quagmire.
Oh, look, it's a disaster, because we have, and this comes back to NPHET not being prepared to give a ruling. If NPHET came out and said, this is what the rules are, the HSA can then come along and put in place the rules for internally in the places, and we're out of the GDPR issue. And one of those would be if they came along and said, well, you have to be vaccinated. Now, I know people will be against that, but let's say they said you had to be vaccinated.
Yeah.
Then, in those circumstances, the employer is able to say, right, to the staff, I need to know if you're vaccinated or not. Oh, you are. Fine. That's great. You're in. Or if you're not vaccinated, well, you have to keep 2 meters apart from each other. So they then know how to split the thing up. They then know how to bring people into the work for restaurants to eat, and they know what they need to do from there. And I mean, look, we have the crazy situation at the present time that restaurants that aren't allowed open, and I've heard of some hotels that are letting anybody in, and they just give you a key. There is a kind of a phantom key if anybody comes in and checks. So, you know, the hotels are operating. So we have non-compliance. Now, by the way, not a very good idea for a hotel to do, because one disgruntled employee raises a complaint, they can be down, bringing you down to the WRC as well. But this is, from an employment law perspective, and I'm an employment lawyer, this is a tsunami of litigation coming in various guises, and something that I don't want to see. I mean, I just want to see people being able to get back to restaurants and pubs safely with clear and definitive rules. And basically, we need NPHET to get off the fence and stop this thing of, which is basically, we want everybody vaccinated and we're going to throw our toys out of the pram unless we get that, and bring in something that is realistic.
Well,
that has to be done.
We'll have to await what arises out of Tuesday's Cabinet meeting to see where we go from here. And as you've already noted, they're going to be assessing their 6 separate options, including delaying the resumption of indoor dining until October. Richard Grogan, solicitor and specialist in employment law and dispute resolution of Richard Grogan and Associates, thank you indeed for joining us. Tomorrow is a very special day here in County Kildare. The county is celebrating National Play Day, and to tell us all about it, I'm joined on the line by Simon Wallace, Senior Executive Parks Superintendent at Kildare County Council. Simon, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks, Ciara.
This is I know it's an annual event in Kildare, and it moved practically online last year, but it's usually an all-risk Kildare in pre-pandemic times. Nearly the whole building is open.
Yeah, that's right, Joe. We usually have a lot of activities going on in outside of the offices and mess, but unfortunately, because of COVID-19, We've had to come up with an alternative to that event.
And it's an inventive alternative, and I know for the last couple of weeks, really since I think on or about the 29th of June, play packs have been given out to kids right across the county.
Yeah, we've distributed 1,000 play packs, so they're available in the main libraries in Athy, Selbridge, Kildare, Leixlip, Manoot, Naas, Newbridge and Monastereven. So they're available from today. There is a small quantity of them, but the idea is to, I suppose, make available some materials that people can make a board game or something out of it.
And what's the theme of this year's National Play Day, Simon?
The theme is Playful Communities. So, as I said, what we've made available is play packs. So they contain some coloured sheets, a tennis ball, coloured chalk, some crayons, stickers and a dice. And what we're asking them to do is to use three of those items to create something playful outside. So a game maybe or activity or some sort of an art project.
There's also a competition though running alongside National Play Day which really enables pretty much all children to get involved if they wish.
Yeah, that's right. They can submit their ideas that they come up with, the items in the play pack, to us. The closing date is Monday the 19th of July, and they can email those a picture of what they've come up with to parks@kildareco.ie.
And I suppose the theory and the impetus, Simon, behind promoting outdoor play is the positive impact it has on children's social, emotional and intellectual well-being.
Yeah, that's right. I suppose with COVID-19, I suppose all options mightn't be available to kids at the moment to play. So we're just trying to help with that by providing play packs, which will give them some activities over the summer.
Well, Simon Wallace, Senior Executive Park Superintendent at Kildare County Council, thank you indeed for joining us. And if you're lucky enough to get your hands on one of those play packs and you wanted to take part in the competition that Simon mentioned, you can, as he said, email your creation, an image of your creation, to parks@kildareco.ie. But you can also get involved on social media using the hashtags Kildare Play Day, Play Pack Challenge and Summer of Play. Now, for the first time since the cyber attack on the health service executive on May 13th, local electoral area data is available on COVID-19 incidence rates. And I just want to take you through it because it's been more than 6 weeks since this information was last available. So the Leixlip local electoral area has the highest 14-day COVID-19 incidence rate in the county at 138.7 cases per 100,000 people. That is, just for context, 16 points above the state's rate for the period June 22nd to July 5th. The state's rate at that time stood at 121.8 cases. So 22 people in the Leixlip local electoral area were diagnosed with the virus in that period. In the Maynooth local electoral area, there were 30 new cases. The incidence rate there is 100.9. The rate in the Selbridge local electoral area, 92.5 cases per 100,000 people, with 20 new cases in that period. 22 people in the Athy local electoral area were diagnosed with COVID-19 in those 2 weeks. The rate there is 82.9. The Naas LEA rate is 79.2 cases per 100,000 people, with 31 new diagnoses. 20 new COVID-19 diagnoses were made in the Clane local electoral area in that fortnight. The rate there is 70.3 per cases per 100,000 people. The Kildare LEA incidence rate is 18 new cases of the virus in that region, while the lowest rate in the county is in the Newbridge local electoral area, 50.7 cases per 100,000 people with 18 new diagnoses. And you can see additional data on all of those incidence rates, including the incidence rate map of County Kildare, in the local news section of kfmradio.com. Coming up after the break, we'll be talking about a research breakthrough in treatment for EB and the Gerard Manley Hopkins Society. Happy and very welcome news for the residents of the 21 nursing homes here in County Kildare and indeed right across Ireland. So restrictions will be lifted on the number of people allowed to visit nursing homes from later this month. New guidance comes into effect on July 19th, but a limit on the number of people who can visit at any one time will continue. Time limits will be scrapped, while family and friends won't have to book their visit in advance. Fewer restrictions will also apply to residents who are going outside nursing homes. So that all kicks in on the 19th of July, and I would imagine would be very welcomed by many, many nursing home residents and indeed their families. Now, UCD researchers have developed what's described as a life-changing treatment for the painful skin condition epidermoloidosis bullosa, known as butterfly skin. Is a genetic condition which causes blistering of the skin. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line now by Jimmy Fearon. He's Chief Executive of Debra Ireland. Jimmy, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having us on the programme.
Delighted, absolutely, to have you. For people who aren't overly familiar with EB, could you share a little with us about what the condition is and just how difficult it is to live with?
Sure. It's a genetic skin condition that is sometimes described as the worst condition you've never heard of, and that's because it affects every organ in the body, even though it's not just the skin. As you may or may not be familiar, is internal as well as external. Our skin runs through our whole body, so it has an impact on the body in terms of nutrition, etc. So the big impact of it on a mummy and daddy who have a new child is that the up to 70% of the skin it could be damaged and blistered, and requiring up to 2 to 3 hour bandage changes every second day, which is pretty horrendous burden on a family. And that's just one of the elements, but that's probably the worst part of it. And frequent trips into either Crumlin or St James's as an adult, who both are kind of our centres of expertise on EB, the two centres in the country. But yeah, it's a pretty, very life-limiting condition, mm-hmm. at its worst. A big challenge for families. And Debra exists to support them and also to invest in research as well to try and find new treatment and a cure.
I have to say, Jimmy, it does sound, particularly for the parents of newborns diagnosed with EB, deeply traumatic for them to render onto their teeny tiny infant the care that they require, and searingly painful for the infant.
Absolutely, absolutely, and the I'm fortunate enough to have three healthy children, but you know, I don't think as parents we're not meant to have to do nursing processes and procedures on a child. I mean, we're there to be hugging them and giving them love, and this forces the parents to have to do a pretty arduous process of removal of bandages and replacement of bandages, and that would involve bursting of blisters as well. So it goes against the natural laws of parenting is how we see it, and hence we try and as much as possible campaign to get nursing care into the home from a very early age, so that the supports are there in place, and the mum and dad can be the person the child comes for a hug for after, as opposed to the mum and dad being the doer of the changes, which is just, as I say, belies the natural laws of parenting, I think.
Tell us about the work that's been done at UCD in terms of research into new treatments.
Yeah, it's Wenxuan Wang has a team in there, and he is he's a chemist initially, and where his focus is the issue with, let's say, recessive dystrophic EB is a damaged protein, and that protein is called collagen 7, and that's the protein that attaches your dermis to your epidermis on your skin, your layers of skin, and that's where the problem is. So what a lot of the research is trying to do is trying to come up with a way to correct the collagen 7, so that new collagen 7 has been developed that has not got that error in it. So it's gene editing. You're getting into DNA here and gene editing, which is quite a complex area, but a fascinating area for the rare diseases area in terms of what the potential impact it can have. So he has developed this delivery mechanism in terms of, trying to get it into your bodily system. We're familiar with injections and blood transfusions, but it's not that straightforward. You're trying to get replace a DNA in there and for the body to accept it, as opposed to naturally rejecting it. So he has developed a delivery mechanism, and then there's another piece of technology called CRISPR-Cas, which helps to actually make the adaptation to the protein. So it's technology that and research that has implications not just for EB but for across the rare disease spectrum. So it's really exciting, and it's great that it's happening so locally as well. Obviously, wherever the research happens, it happens. But obviously, it's nice to know that it's happening in Ireland, and that UCD are taking the charge. The Charles Institute are leading the charge. They have an institute there which is one of the few centres for dermatological research in the world. It's called the Charles Institute. And that houses a number of clinicians or researchers in there, and this is one of the projects they're working on. So it's very exciting. Now it's early days, you know, in the sense of we've all become very familiar now with because of COVID with the whole phase one, phase two clinical trials, you know, clinical trials, phase three, and then bringing it onto the markets, because generally that would take a number of years generally to go through those phases. We've seen with COVID, because of the urgency of it, it happened extremely quickly. I mean, never in the history of medicine or research, I don't think that has anything happened so quickly, but it was obviously needed. So we'd love that urgency to be applied to EB across the board on
and
research.
Jimmy, at what phase of research are both of these separate potential treatments?
The combination of the two is phase one. It's early stages. It's early stage. So it's proof. It's still there's been proof of concept, but if this all kept going and the statistics and the stats kept good, it could be maybe 4 to 5 years maybe before it comes to the market. But that in our world is exciting, because there's no treatment in Ireland or in the world for EB. There's no nothing has been developed yet that is is a treatment for EB. So the last few years have been particularly good. There's a lot of biotech investment in the area, and there's a lot of different gene therapy, protein therapy, bone marrow replacement, Botox, believe it or not, is used in as a potential treatment as well. So there's a wide range of scientists working, and it's the only reason they're doing it is one of the reasons they're doing it is because we've DEBRA Ireland and DEBRA International have funded early stage research. And it's like planting a seed and waiting for it to grow. And thank God a number of those seeds have grown, and there's a lot of activity going on worldwide.
Well, certainly it does, Jimmy, seem as if this research at UCD is a beacon of hope. Jimmy Fearon, Chief Executive of DEBRA Ireland, thank you indeed for joining us. Years and years and star-struck. Now, celebrations of Gerard Manley Hopkins move online this year with a free virtual festival on July 24th, brought to you by the Monastery Evan Hopkins Society. Joined on the line now by its chairperson, Richard O'Rourke. Richard, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you, Ciara. Thanks for the opportunity to speak to you.
You're very, very welcome. Tell us what's in store on the 24th.
Well, it's a very much shortened version of the usual festival, but we felt we had to do something. Last year stopped us altogether in our tracks. And we said we'd put on some token event. But it's a nice lecture on Hopkins as a traditionalist and poetic innovator, which will be a nice lecture. It's by a lady, Hilary Davies. She's an English, Welsh poet, a lovely lady, and she's going to give us a reading of some of her poetry as well. And then we have a lecture by a gentleman, Will Daunt, also from England. He's from a little village near Liverpool, just 10 miles north of Liverpool, called Lydiate, which Hopkins visited and bears much resemblance to Monastery Evan in many respects.
How so, Richard?
Well, it's a small village. Monastery Evan, a population of under 5,000, and Hopkins visited friends there, like he visited friends here in Monastery Evan, and he wrote a lovely poem about a farrier that he was attending as a priest, and that he anointed and befriended, and who passed away sadly. But he wrote a really touching poem about this Felix Randall the farrier, and it would have a lot of resonances here in Kildare, where we're so familiar with the thoroughbred industry and farriery.
And then there'll also be a poetry reading by Hilary Davies. The important thing I think about this, Richard, for particularly for people who may not be as familiar with Jared Manley Hopkins or his connections to Kildare, is that this is free to attend. It's open to the entire world if they wish.
Indeed, yes. We have people logged in, registered or subscribed from America and Poland and, well, Ireland, of course, and the UK. So it is. It's a sort of an international event, more so than even previously.
And how can people sign up to take part, Richard? Where do they drop an email? Where do they log on?
Well, they go to the Monastrevin Hopkins Society website, which is monastrevinhopkinssociety.org, all one word, lowercase. And in there, they'll see details of how to subscribe, because we have GDPR and all that. People have to subscribe to give us permission to contact them, and then we contact them and give them the link to the Zoom event.
Well, and is there a closing date by which they have to do that, Richard, or can you do that right up to the start of the online festival?
Well, we haven't put in a closing date, but we would like people to subscribe earlier rather than later, because on the day it's going to be very busy with the lecturers are coming in from the UK and connecting people from God knows where. So that we would like people to register or subscribe at least a day or two or more before.
Well, Richard O'Rourke, chairperson of the Monastrevin Hopkins Society, thank you indeed for joining us there to share with us the details of your online celebration of Gerald Manley Hopkins on July 24th. Just some breaking news. Mary Lou MacDonald, the leader of Sinn Féin, has conceded for now that her party's candidate, Lynn Boylan, has not won the Dublin Bay South by-election. Mary Lou MacDonald says it's very clear from the results that this is Ivana's day, Ivana being Labour's Ivana Bacik. Mary Lou MacDonald adds, it's now very clear this is a government living on borrowed time. We also want to let you know that streaming via the KFM website is not operable at the moment. This is not a KFM issue. It's an issue elsewhere that has impacted our site. We'll bring you updates on that as soon as is humanly possible, and we will notify you as soon as that service is restored. Coming up after the break, we'll be talking about barriers of prejudice in education. Now, I'm joined on the line by Richard Hogan, Clinical Director at the Therapy Institute, a systemic family psychotherapist and a teacher, and he has written extensively in the Irish Examiner on the concept of breaking down the barriers of prejudice in education, and it's on this matter he joins me. Richard, you're very welcome to the programme.
Good morning, Curious. Lovely to be on the show.
We're delighted to have you, as always, particularly on something such as this, because when we're talking about barriers to education, we often think, and rightly so in many ways, about socioeconomic barriers. We don't think about the barriers that may exist in the classroom because of people's preconceived notions.
Absolutely, Kira. And I'm currently over here in America, in Seattle, on a Fulbright scholarship exploring this exact idea, because it's a passion of mine, because as a young kid growing up in Cork, I had dyslexia myself, and I didn't know it. I was undiagnosed until I was in fifth class, and I certainly felt excluded from the educational experience many times. And it wasn't until until I got into college and I started really looking at this idea about how do we include people, that I started to look at the ideas that often it's the beliefs that the person holds in the classroom, the teacher holds, that often limits a child's participation in the class. And so often with education, unfortunately, what we find, especially with disability or intellectual disability, often it's society's limiting view that can actually disable. It can have a disabling impact on a disabled person, or it can have a disabling impact on someone who has an intellectual difficulty. And it's really about time that we changed it. It's really about time that we took the same stance that we took to, last month we celebrated Pride Month, and we started to celebrate people's different way of learning. I think it's a really key idea that we don't all learn the same way, and we have to start celebrating that.
I think that that's a really important point, because the educational system, not exclusively in Ireland, in the vast majority, if not all, of the Western world, is set up to cater to or to confer learning upon people who are neurotypical but also learn in a very specific way. So whether you're neurotypical or not, if you don't learn well through rote learning, the system is not designed and set up for you. So it seems that when you combine everybody who doesn't learn in that specific way and isn't neurotypical, the group of so-called outliers, the people who are othered by the educational system, actually outweigh the number of people for whom it seems the educational system was set up to cater to.
I would absolutely agree with you, Keir. That's why I actually love coming on the show, because you've got such great insights into education, to be honest. And it's absolutely what the, you know, it's true, though, and it's what the case is. And I think that, you know, it's something I'm really passionate about, obviously, because I experienced it myself. But, you know, the destructive label the child develops very young in their mind, and then the internalized prejudice they say to themselves about being stupid or not as clever as, or being different, because they perceive themselves to learn differently. And as a result of that difference, you know, when you're a teenager, you see yourself as being, you know, odd, weird, or whatever it is, freak. These are all the words I hear in my clinics when teenagers come in and talk about their, you know, difference in learning. And as you said yourself, the reality is those who thrive through the rote learning system that our education system is today are actually the minority. And it suits a particular type of student. And our education system needs to really move forward here. I think we're quite anachronistic and quite archaic in our approach. Perhaps maybe the pandemic has disrupted that, and maybe we might be looking at a different way of approaching education. But I think it's about, you know, it's really about time that we changed it.
And I would imagine there are a lot of people listening to you and I talk, Richard, that are to a degree surprised by what you're saying, because I would imagine that the received wisdom is outside of educational circles, that if you live with dyslexia, for example, you won't be subjected today to the same treatment that you would have gotten in a classroom 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years ago. But just because the treatment is different doesn't mean its impact is any lesser.
Absolutely. No, of course, we have moved on in our understanding. And I was a kid in the 80s when I was experiencing this. My daughter, Hannah, who's 10, is dyslexic. And I can see it's a different experience for her, but I work really hard with her to change that internalized voice, you know, because I know it's there, and she feels it herself, and she has to leave the class to go out to resource. So, you know, it is different, but it's absolutely there. When you separate a child out and you get them, you know, when they feel like they're different from everybody else, that's where it develops. And it's really, we don't really understand what dyslexia really is, you know. And the idea of, like, learning difficulty, I think we need to even reframe that, change that idea. We're different learners. And the sooner we accept that we learn differently and try to shove children into the one kind of system for learning, it just has a deleterious impact on well-being and a child's sense of self. And it restricts them until they get into their adulthood. And I hear it in my clinic, you know. Sorry.
And I think that's a really crucial point about reframing the language, because, you know, if you tell a child that part of the way that they are and part of who they are is a difficulty or is a problem, they're going to absorb that into their entire being, as would an adult. But if you change it into you learn differently to the person you sit beside, that's not such a big deal.
Exactly, and that's absolutely, I think, part of the crux here. When you hear the word difficulty or learning, you know, impaired or difficulty, you know, or challenge that you have or problem that you have, it's all such negative language, and the child will really internalize that, and that's the work, you know, that we need to do. And when you say something like difference, when you learn differently, now you're celebrating the uniqueness of the person, and I think that's what needs to happen. I think the reframing is probably first fundamental step here. And there'll be many of your listeners who have children who are learning in a different way. Be listening to this today, will be thinking to themselves, you know, God, it's great to hear something positive about this, because it is a positive thing. If we all learned the same way, we would never have persisted as a society. We would never have got as far as we have come as a people. So the difference is really important. And I think schools need to really, you know, move forward with this and change it so that our children are able to thrive.
What, if any, do you see as the barriers to that evolution in the educational system? Is it more an ambition towards that, or are there structural issues? Are there resource issues?
I think fundamentally, I think the teacher training program needs to change. I think the idea is that teachers, you know, the reality is teachers are more than likely, you know, coming from a particular socioeconomic background, they have a particular understanding of education, and perhaps no, you know, they didn't experience the difficulty themselves as going through, or they didn't learn differently than others as they were going through. So they would have received maybe ideas about somebody who has dyslexia or dyspraxia or dyscalculia. And so it's those ideas, those little kind of subconscious perhaps triggers or subconscious biases that they might have, I think feed into how they interact with a child in the classroom who is different. And I think fundamentally the training needs to change, and that's the kind of work I'm doing at the moment, is how to write a program for the teacher training programs that teach teachers how to think about their children in a different way, how to think about difference in a different way, and how to think about children who learn differently in a more progressive way.
Well, Richard Hogan, now Fulbright scholar, but clinical director at the Therapy Institute, also a teacher and a systemic family psychotherapist. Thank you indeed, as ever, for joining us.